Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Today's special guest, celebrated comedian and author Jessica Holmes, has always applied humor as healing balm for life's scrapes and bruises. Since childhood, she has kept a funny journal, recording bizarre moments that reminded her life is most often more comedy than tragedy. Jessica shot to stardom on her own Carol Burnett-style sketch series, The Holmes Show, and then Royal Canadian Air Force, that then started booking high-profile gigs such as opening for Jerry Seinfeld and Ellen DeGeneres. From the outside, it seemed like Jessica Holmes had it all, but on the inside, she was suffering in silence after recovering from postpartum depression years earlier. She entered a familiar slump. When she wasn't glued to her couch, surrounded by junk food, she was avoiding her agent and yawning through gigs, even when emceeing for one of her idols, Oprah Winfrey. Her book, Depression, the Comedy, describes how she eventually came to terms with depression. After battling both postpartum depression and regular run-of-the-mill garden variety depression, in her words. She became a life and career coach and now tours regularly at motivational speaking circuits. In the spring of 2018, she became an ambassador for the Bell Let's Talk campaign for mental health and started a comedic online photo campaign to help others feel less isolated. So we're going to have a great show with Jessica, I'm sure. Her book is really entertaining. So let me bring her on and introduce you, and we'll get started. Good morning, Jessica.
Hey, Randy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is my absolute pleasure. It's great to meet you, and you are welcome. Thank you for being my guest.
My story. There is a cat on this table. This is hilarious. I have a home office, and as you can hear, it's a bit mildly chaotic sometimes with animals.
Oh, okay. Yes, I heard. I did hear. So let's talk first about you being a comedian. Did you always know that from the time you were a child, that you saw things in a different way?
I knew that my favorite thing in the world to do was to hear people tease each other, joke around. I have a gigantic family, so many aunts and uncles and cousins, and I would love to just sit quietly on the sofa and watch them all interact, and then I would write down the funny things they would say. But I never, it never occurred to me that that would be a career for me. I just knew that when I was trying to be serious, people would laugh. So I thought, okay, I guess being serious won't be something I'll be successful at in life. And then friends in university dared me to try stand-up. We dared each other, four of us, and we went out, and it was terrifying. We went to an open mic night and did stand-up, but even though it was like 80% awful, 20% exciting, I got hooked on that exciting part, and I caught the bug and became a comedian that night.
Wow. So you finished going to the university and then started a career with this, or did you start while you were in college?
I started while I was in college, and it's being a comedian, it's just, you know, 10 minutes every night type of thing. So I would go every night and perform, and during the day I would do classes, or I, you know, go temp at different business places. It was a really exciting time in my life because I don't think I had two spare minutes. But, you know, when you're 20, you just don't care. There's nothing wrong with like going 16 hours a day straight. And that's what I did, and paid my dues for about 2 years. I just did it for free. You know, sometimes you'd get a beer ticket, or sometimes there were two people in the audience, and but I just kept going and going, and I loved it. I felt like I had found my home. And about 2 years into it, I got my first tiny acting job, and I always say, like, if I hadn't fallen into it, if someone hadn't dared me, if I hadn't gotten that first job, I might have wandered away, because it's not, comedy isn't the greatest lifestyle in terms of, there's sometimes too much downtime, too much time to think. And then you only go out at night, which is at bars. There's a lot of drinking, a lot of sort of negative comedians at the back of the room. And so I even knew then it wasn't the healthiest place in the world. But once I started working in TV, I thought, okay, this is more my milieu. This is where I can feel comfortable.
And tell us about that experience. So what was it like working in TV, and what exactly, you know, did you do?
Yeah, so I had two very successful series in Canada, The Holmes Show, which was my own kind of Carol Burnett show, and then Royal Canadian Air Farce, which was taking on politics every week. And I'd play anyone from Britney Spears to Michael Jackson, and it was kind of natural to see him as a young white woman. I had such a blast doing those characters, and I loved it. And I ended up quitting that second series when I was in the middle of a depression, but I didn't know that I was depressed. And I just thought, I guess I don't love my job, and I guess I don't love people, and I guess I don't love work. And only later did we put two and two together and realize it was depression. But at the time, I thought I had just fallen out of love with television. But honestly, who would say that? Who could fall out of love with TV?
Right, exactly. But, you know, in your book, you go through like a conversation that you had with your therapist, you know, and you sort of thought other things. You thought it was your husband, everything he did felt wrong, and, you know, it was hard to pinpoint exactly what was going on there, right? You didn't know exactly what was happening,
yeah.
What was coming. Yeah.
And that's what I'm hearing from a lot of, when I do these shows, these live shows where I talk about my mental health experience, I do get a lot of people coming up to tell me their spouse is very much in the same predicament. Like, they have a sense that their spouse might be depressed or going through some kind of mental illness, but their spouse keeps just saying, you're the problem. You know, if I had a better husband, if you were a better wife. And so I think for so many of us, it's because it doesn't, you know, when you have everything on paper, like I have a job, I have friends, I have support, it just never occurred to me that I would be depressed, because there aren't the ingredients that would add up to a depression. I'm a resilient person. I had been to that point. And so it was easier for me to just convince myself my husband was the problem. So I blamed him for everything, like every mood I would get in, anything that would set my temper off. And what a saint he was. But it was him who finally said, I can't take this anymore, and we need to go see a marriage counselor. And I think on my second visit, she diagnosed me with depression. And I was a bit relieved because I felt like, okay, so I am with the right person. He is the love of my life. I can stay in this marriage if I get myself healed. But then, of course, it was also bad news because I had been depressed before. I had had postpartum depression. So for this second depression to come meant that I was kind of a repeat a depressed person. And when you have been depressed more than once, even when you're feeling great, even when you're recovered, you aren't considered out of the woods. You're just considered in remission. You're almost considered in between depressions. And so I have to live the rest of my life every single day taking care of my mental health and making sure that I don't fall back into that. But so that part of it felt overwhelming to me because I was just like, oh, what a bum deal I got. I have a wonderful life and I just can't appreciate it over and over again. Wow.
You know, mental health is something I think that most people have issues with. And I think it's important to be aware of the fact that you can fall into these things at any given time because the world that we live in is very difficult. And we all tend to fall into things that are not necessarily mentally healthy for us. So I don't know that you don't want to be diagnosed with a condition, like a lifetime condition that you're going to have to deal with. But I don't think it's bad to be aware of your mental health at all times. I know that I am, because of my childhood, I've had to be very conscientious of the things I can fall into, the traps that I can fall into. So, I have to keep myself, my life stress-free. I have to live in a way that keeps me out of that mindset.
I agree with you that it's actually a blessing in disguise when you have to look out for your mental health. The types of things that I do to make myself feel great include exercise, socializing, going to bed early, eating healthier, and those things, even though they took me a long time to kind of get used to, and I was discouraged at the start, those things I feel like give me an even better life than I had before I went through any of this. So I have no complaints now, and I feel like that's my message to people when they're in the audience is to let them know, even if today you're on the sofa and you feel hopeless, I've been there, so many people have been there, and then things turn around and you do get better and you live a life you can't even imagine. I remember thinking when I had postpartum depression, I remember thinking, well, I guess I'm just going to pretend that I'm happy being a mom. Like I'll just pretend and it'll be like an acting job for me. And I'll just pretend my whole life. And then, cut to 6 months later when I had recovered, I was like, oh my gosh, I love this. I understand now why people say it's the greatest gift in the world. And so sometimes depression does rob someone of the ability to see that tomorrow could be any different. You know, it robs your optimism. And my message is usually just to let people know it does seem unrealistic that it could ever get better, but it actually does. And then the other point you were touching on was that a lot of people have mental health issues. And for some people, even if you don't have depression, I'm sure there's an area of your life where you feel like you've let things slide, where you feel like you're in a slump, or you've just kind of dropped the bar, lowered your expectations to feel less than satisfactory in any one area. And so that's part of my message too, is just, you know what, you were born entitled to have a great life. And so check in with yourself every now and then. Ask yourself, how am I doing in terms of relationships, finance, life satisfaction, fulfillment, health, those different areas, and just make sure you're feeling like a 7 out of 10 or higher in them. And if there's an area you're not, it's a good time to take a look at that because things are fixable.
Yeah. And, and that's sort of like, cause I talk a lot about, this self-love, and there's actually 7 different ways that we can have self-love. And, but basically that's what you're saying. It's really to check in and see that you are taking care of yourself on all levels and protecting yourself on all levels. It seems that, we hear that lots of comedians suffer depression. Now, some of them have suffered it their entire lives, but that wasn't true for you, right?
No, I had the most Camelot-like upbringing, and I felt like a well-adjusted person. I was someone you could always count on to get things done with a big smile, and I guess that's why it shocked me so much that I would be in a depression. It still seems like, hey, that doesn't jive with my personality. That doesn't make any sense. But for comedians, like so one of the chapters where I wrote what comes first, the depression or the comedy, and I discussed it with a few other comedians to find out, like, did this job do this to us? Can a career make someone depressed, or do we come into this kind of susceptible? And the answer is going to be different for most people, but comedians, they have a higher rate of depression than in other careers, and I think it's a mix. I think if you're the kind of person who wants to get on stage and, you know, spin life on its head and look at life in a cynical way, I think you have a certain personality that might, you know, be inclined to do a lot of deep thinking, a lot of internalizing. And then you have this career filled with highs and lows. And so, for example, in my own career, I would go from opening for Jerry Seinfeld. What an incredible thing. And then my phone doesn't ring for 2 months and no one needs me. No one wants me. I try and book a gig for a diaper commercial and they're like, no, we're not interested. Like one time a breakdown went out for a commercial and they actually said, we're looking for a Jessica Holmes type. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. Submit me, agent, submit me. And the agent submitted me and they said, no, we don't want Jessica Holmes. We just want someone like Jessica Holmes. It was a horrible feeling because I was like, I can't even book my own type. What? Sometimes it feels like there's no rhyme or reason. And you would think in your career, you want to have a sense that hard work pays off. If you're kind to people, if you work hard and have a good attitude, you want to know that you'll advance. And it's sometimes in this career that works out and you do advance. And then sometimes you'll advance, but then take 3 steps backwards or be blacklisted for no reason or even just be a working comedian, but who's on the road all the time, staying in hotels by yourself, and it does get lonely on the road. So I think there's a bit of the perfect storm building up there.
Can I backtrack for a second? Okay, sure.
Well, I just wanted to ask, you mentioned the 7 different ways to have self-love. Is there any chance during our talk that you can elaborate on that? I'm so curious.
Yeah, actually, it's in my book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, but I'm actually turning to it right now. So there are different, okay, so the 7 components, I should say, involved in building self-love, and there are several, you know, there's things listed under each of it, but one is self-understanding, so knowing what you like and don't like and how you feel and why you react, your vulnerabilities, those kind of things. The second one is self-acceptance, which means accepting everything about you, that people will like and not, you know, some will like you, not like you, accepting that what you look like, if you're overweight, if you have quirks and flaws, just really accepting who you are for that value. The third one is self-appreciation, which is liking yourself and appreciating that your body does wonderful things for you, appreciating your qualities and your talents and things like that. The fourth one is self-respect, which is the choice to bring positive things into your life, to set limits and boundaries and being authentic. The fifth one is self-forgiveness, being able to forgive yourself and others, learning to grow from your experiences, letting yourself off the hook. And the sixth one is self-protection, which is trusting your judgment, trusting only the trustworthy, refusing to tolerate disrespect, so forth and so on. And then the last one is self-pampering, which is something that we all like to do, but sometimes we don't, taking baths, taking day trips, getting massages, meditating, things like that. So that's what I meant when I said that. And what I tell people is that we would not have gotten to where we are if we don't have some of those components of self-love, because, you know, if you didn't love yourself at all, you wouldn't be here. But so we've all achieved some of it. But in this chapter, I kind of direct people to this because you can go through it and you can say, okay, well, I've done this, you know, but I really could use work in this area. And then you kind of tick away at it. So
that is incredible. And you know what, if I look back and think about when I was in the depression or when I was kind of getting close to the depression, I feel like there's so many of those areas where, you know, where I didn't have self-acceptance, where I didn't have self-forgiveness or self-protection even. And a part of that in comedy is you, and I guess this would be the same for anyone who's an entrepreneur or who works in show business in any capacity, your ego drives so much of it. And social media, that's part of my recovery was, you know, making sure that I only go on social media 2 or 3 times a day instead of being glued to it. So much of it is ego driven and feeling like you have to keep up with the Joneses and being results oriented. Whereas now I'm just process oriented. I feel like, what does my heart want to express today? And then I set about doing that type of work. And then I feel better about it. And I know audiences receive that better because I'm being real. I'm being truthful and honest. It's not just, here's a bikini pic. It's here's something that I, you know, really feel passionately about and something I learned. And my heart feels the best when I do that type of thing. And even things like learning boundaries a little better when your job is to put your heart on the line. You know, I would let a lot of people in and these weren't the best people in the world. And I kind of didn't know how to, I was always scared of losing opportunities if I wasn't, if I didn't allow these people into my life. And I've since learned life is too short and I would rather, I'd rather fail, but have good people around me than win, but have these people that just make me miserable or that I don't trust around me. So I've said no to certain jobs or opportunities. But you know what? I feel good about it. I feel like it was still the right choice because I don't think that the universe or a higher power or even, you know, the self-protection part of me would have done well working with people I don't trust.
Right. It's true. It's true. You know, I tell people you have to be viciously self-protective, like a mother lion and over her cubs, over yourself. You have to be that viciously self-protective. You cannot afford to let anybody in. And there was something that Dr. Phil said recently. I love to just bring this up because I think it's so important. But he was saying that there used to be a time, I guess, when things were slower and before, you know, before life got all technical and stuff like that, where we gave people the benefit of the doubt. He said, "This in this world, we have to do it the opposite. We don't give people the benefit of the doubt until they earn it." And, you know, kind people tend to think that this is what we are supposed to do. We're supposed to just, you know, let people in and see how it goes until they screw us and then, you know, and then deal with it. But no, we have to be protective from the start. And that's the way our society works. And the other thing you said, you said something really important about social media. And I am right with you on this. I think that things like Facebook, personal pages, I mean, not business pages, but personal pages on Facebook, can be extremely depressing. And I know I feel great until I go on my Facebook page. And then all of a sudden I feel
cause I'm like,
less than, right? You know?
Well, yeah, because why does everybody but me have a boat? Why does everybody but me have a cottage? Why does everybody but me this? And then, you know, it's interesting. My husband is a spiritual coach. And so in his practice, of course, he can't reveal to me any specifics, but he just said half the people that he sees, a lot of their emotional problems stem from social media. So half the people he's seeing, it's because social media just creates this whirlwind of self-esteem issues in people and a sense of failure or a sense of loneliness. And I don't think you can really believe half of what you see on there because we're all just putting our best foot forward. Like, my gosh, I have so many filters on every photo I put up because I don't, you know, hide the wrinkles and hide the whatever. But I guess it's too bad that social media isn't a tool for making us feel more connected to each other, like making people feel like, you know what, it's not just you. I see a beautiful trend right now. For example, there's a woman I follow on Instagram, and all of her posts, and she has hundreds of thousands of followers, all of her posts are just about embracing her stretch marks. She has had 3 kids and she put on some weight and she's very beautiful and she's just going to keep posting beautiful pictures of herself with her stretch marks until people feel better about their stretch marks. So something like that, I feel like, oh, that's so beautiful. Like you are using this in a really good way. And it gets counterintuitive because you want the little ego boost. You want to post a beautiful picture or a successful story and you want people to see it. But I have to fight against that every day. And sometimes I'll even post something and then I'll take it off because I ask myself, is it real? Is it helpful? And is it fun? And if it's not real or helpful or fun, I take it down. Even if it was a great picture, even if it was a great success moment. Because I have people that I love that I celebrate my successes with. I don't need to put those out for strangers to validate me for. I want to use social media differently than that, but it's absolutely a work in progress. Oh my gosh, it's a work in progress.
What you just said is exactly what I was going to say. You know, I've been married for 31 years. I've celebrated 31 anniversaries. I don't need to tell anybody that it's my anniversary. I don't need to tell anybody how wonderful my husband is. I don't need to tell anybody that he sent me roses. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Well,
but when you look
and on
there,
Valentine's
you think
Day,
that everybody's you think everybody's husband is better than yours, and their kids are. It's like ridiculous.
Yep.
So
It's,
so let's get back to the depression thing.
Sure.
So what's the difference between just being depressed and having clinical depression?
Well, I know the difference between feeling sad or being in a slump, the difference between that and being in an actual clinical depression, you have certain symptoms every day, most of the day, for longer than 2 weeks. And those symptoms include, so you only have to have like 5 of these out of this long list, but they're things like feeling angry, feeling weepy, feeling discouraged, having either a loss of appetite or a gain of appetite, trouble sleeping, mysterious aches and pains, a feeling of hopelessness. And I had a few thoughts about suicide. And I had I had 5 or 6 of them. And in its worst, my depression was me sitting on the sofa almost all day, every day. And I would watch TV to sort of drown out my thoughts. But then I would cry because I felt like I had just wasted a day watching TV. And then I would eat to make myself feel better. And then I'd cry because I'd feel like, oh my God, I'm so useless. I just ate this big bag of junk food and I don't care about it. And so it was like I kept doing self-harming things and wasting my own time and then feeling worse and worse and worse about it. And that part lasted about 6 months, but I hid it from everybody. I told my husband I was just watching these shows to get ideas for pitching my own TV series. And when my kids would come home at the end of the day, I would just put on the happiest face I could and I would fake it for them. And I really worried when I recovered that I had maybe damaged my kids because I was only ever fake with them and I still would lose my temper. I couldn't help it. Sometimes if I spilled a glass of milk, I would, I'd have like Donald Duck steam shooting out of my ears and drop an F-bomb. And, I asked my therapist, have I ruined them? Was that kind of the one shot I had? She actually said, no, she said, kids, who go out into the world thinking that their parents are perfect and that life doesn't have any stumbling blocks, they're going to get knocked down pretty hard later in life. So she said it's what she counseled me against, though, was spoiling the kids to make up for the depression. Because what I found I did when I recovered was I just said yes to everything they wanted. I just wanted to make up for lost time. I'd be like, see how much mommy loves you. You can do anything you want. And my therapist was like, no, that's ridiculous. That would do more harm than you having been in a depression. Because she said kids feel safest when they have rules and boundaries. And so I had to learn the word no. And I got really, really good at it. And now my kids, I would say they're 10 and 12 now. And I feel like we're all great friends, but I do have strong boundaries and they know that no means no. And I think if anything, that would be the blessing I'm most grateful for, is seeing that what I went through didn't in fact ruin my children, didn't in fact, you know, set them on a course of destruction. But that they are resilient and that it's, you know, it's not too late to kind of turn things around.
Right. Absolutely. I relate to that, you know, the steam coming out of your ears when they spilled milk, because I was like that when my daughter was very young, and I didn't realize I had a terrible anxiety disorder. Everything would send me, and I would yell at her all the time, and it wasn't until she was this little sweet little thing, and she would say, Mommy, she would tell me about her dreams, Mommy, last night I had a dream, and every time she told me, I was angry in the dream, and I thought, oh my God, what am I doing?
Oh, wow.
So mm-hmm. I went in and I went to a psychiatrist and I figured it out, because, you know, and then I apologized to her. I said, you know, this mommy had a sickness and that's why I did it, but it had nothing to do with you. And she's grown up just perfect. So I don't have to worry about that.
And you know what, our kids generation.
We can be real with our kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing to me, their generation is more open about mental health. And my kids, both of them, even just in these, you know, young grades that they're in, my daughter just did a presentation on depression. My son, you know, they have Pink Shirt Day where they talk about bullying and its impact on mental health. And so I think it's terrific. I feel like they're going to have the tools and the vocabulary to deal with mental health issues so much better, so they can undo some of the damage social media does.
I'm so happy to hear that. Because it all these shootings and everything, it all starts with school, with the children getting these tools for dealing with their mental health, knowing how to cope with life, all these kind of things. Let's talk about your book. I want to make sure we get to all these topics so I cover everything.
Sure.
Your book is called Depression the Comedy, A Tale of Perseverance. Tell us about this book, why you wrote it, and sort of what the whole, just the style. You can talk about that.
When I was depressed, I felt like I wanted to know a little more about it, but anytime I would read a book about it, it would trigger further depression and further sadness. So when I recovered, I thought, what's a way that I can, with my comedy, just be really lighthearted about it and write about it in a way that, yes, reveals what it feels like to be depressed, but also gives people a lot of hope and just makes them laugh. And I'm never making fun of depression itself, because that is not funny, but I do make fun of the ways that I mistook my symptoms or the trouble I got into when I got on the wrong antidepressant that made me think every thought I had should be said out loud to every audience, and the embarrassment that follows that. How my relationships with my friends changed, how I now need to live like I'm an 80-year-old down wintering in Florida, because I go to bed early and I eat vegetable soup all day. And so it's kind of just going through in a lighthearted way that won't trigger anyone. It's letting people know you're not alone, and there is a time and a way to get out of this. And you won't even believe how good your life can become, how it can go from a place of such darkness to a place of such love. And I actually recently posted about this, but my husband and I remember I really didn't like myself. I think I kind of hated myself when I was in the depression, and I hated him, I guess, for not being able to fix me for not being able to heal me. Whatever kind of deep psychological dance we were doing there. And I remembered thinking, he's like an annoying little brother. I don't even understand how I'm supposed to be married, but you know what? You're supposed to, if you have kids together, you're supposed to stay married. So fine, I'll stay married till our kids grow up. Cut to 4 years later, I'm out of this depression And I can't get enough of the guy. Like, I love him as though we were on our fifth date. I'm smitten. And I didn't know that I could ever get back to this place again because he's the same person he always was. But now he's not my annoying little brother. He's my knight in shining armor. And it's only because I am healthy. And so I feel like that's a really great message of hope that I wrote a few chapters about marriage in the book, because like I said, it's, you know, it would be the number one thing a depressed person would sort of lash out at their partner. And so I really wanted people to know it can turn around. It can become something beautiful and romantic again, even if you thought everything was lost and that there's no salvaging it. Or if you feel like there's no salvaging yourself and there is hope, there is a chance. So, yeah, I wanted to put it in a book that was easy to read, that was silly, that was lighthearted.
Yeah, and I really think you accomplished that. And I think that what you just said is a great message. It really is, that things can turn around. And it's something that, you know, I always thought about. It's like I think about back to when I was in my 20s and how every day it seemed like tomorrow was never going to be any different, you know, and you do not have the benefit of hindsight. You can't look back with any kind of track record and see, you know, but as you get older, you can see that we can get through these things no matter how bad they feel today. And that there is always some kind of movement in the universe. Nothing is ever stagnant. Things change. And so when you feel like you've dead-ended, you really never have. I wanted to ask you how you actually healed from this. Did you come through it? Did you need medication? Was it counseling? What was it that helped you?
When I had postpartum depression, the medication and a couple of lifestyle changes helped me get through that. But with this depression, I found that the antidepressants didn't make a very big difference. The main things that I would say were having a new perspective where I don't beat myself up so often, where I don't ruminate. I didn't even know rumination was a word, but that's exactly what I was doing, where you keep repeating to yourself the same terrible thing. So I would sit on that sofa and I would say, I'm useless. My peers are embarrassed for me. People think I'm a failure. And then I would just keep repeating it, and I'd get more worked up the more I'd say it. So now I have a healthier outlook where I recognize those thoughts as just ridiculous, ego-driven, and that they have no place in my life. So I had to do a lot of work mentally, like develop new patterns, and that's what I did with a therapist. So therapy was number one for me, and it does take a few tries sometimes to find a therapist that you gel with, but keep going because they really are worth their weight in gold. And then exercise and structure became big things for me. Like I realized I have my best energy is in the morning. So I jog every morning with my dog. I write for 2 hours every morning. And then at least my day has a great trajectory. Like whatever my afternoon looks like, at least my morning was good. And I have a strong sense of accomplishment. Because when you're self-employed, you do kind of have to keep yourself going and find little tricks that help you feel good about yourself and your choices all day long, so that it doesn't just seem like some vast universe out there and you could make the wrong choice at any second. So exercise, doing team sports really helped, because even when you don't feel like it, you know, people are counting on you. It gives you a sense of community. And I would say the one I still have to work on is, because it's a bit complicated, I get that I'm a comedian and I do get on stage in front of 1,000 people and tell jokes, but I'm also an introvert when I'm not working. And so I would find it hard because I would get lonely. I didn't want to be around people, but I wanted to feel connected. And so that's something that's still a work in progress for me, where I have to make sure even if I'm drained by being around people, I still do need to have them in my life. So, you know, I'll make sure that I have a jogging partner, or I'll make sure that I hop on the phone with my parents every day, or, you know, it's just trying to make sure that I still stay in touch and have a feeling of community and support, and just not overdoing it so that I feel like exhausted by people.
That's a really good point. Yeah. So are you involved? So I know that you had started this Bell Let's Talk campaign for mental health. What is that? Or you're an ambassador for it?
Yeah, so Howie Mandel would be the most recognizable name on it. It's an initiative where the Bell phone company donates 5 cents from every call on this Bell Let's Talk Day. They donate it to mental health. So I think $95 million has been raised in the last 8 years. And it's just an initiative where they're trying to reduce the stigma of mental health. So they get people talking about it. So it's just a great reminder to all of us that depression isn't your fault, and you do have every right to speak up, even if it's in your workplace, to say, I'm not okay right now, I'm not feeling great right now, so that people don't think depression is something that happens to other people or that it's some dark, shameful secret. It's not a sexually transmitted disease. It's just a mental health issue that one in five of us get, and you didn't do anything wrong to cause it, and you're not a bad person if you have it, and there is a way out of it. So right now the stage we're at is just education. We just need to be more educated for ourselves, but also to not make other people feel badly about wherever they're at on their journey.
That's terrific. That's really a great campaign. Mm-hmm. So it's Bell, B-E-L-L, Let's Talk. Okay, so where do we get your book, and how can you be reached? Do you have a website?
Sure, yes. My website is jessicaholmes.com, plain and simple. And then my book, it's available at select bookstores, but then also just on Amazon.
Okay, and that's pretty much where everybody shops anyway, right?
I know.
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, it's
right.
Why kind
shop
of the
anywhere
easiest place
else?
To get it.
You know, you order it and it's there in 2 days if you have Prime. So, I love Prime.
Mm-hmm. I love the
anyway.
Series. I'm quite a TV girl.
Oh, okay.
But,
yeah, I like
yeah.
That
so
too.
It was. Oh, that's wonderful. And yeah, my greatest pleasure is getting in front of an audience and doing stand-up comedy that also has a positive mental health message in it. And that's what I tried to do with the book, was to just make it look like you're reading a comedy, but P.S., depression is not your fault, and you can come out the other side.
That's great. I'm so proud of you for where you've come, you know, where you've come from, and because I know how hard it is to get there. Because this is what I work with people all the time who are trying to achieve that. And it is an uphill climb and a very arduous one. So congratulations on being able to get there to a healthy place and to use that platform to help other people. I'm really all for that. So thank you for that.
And thank you so much for... honestly, for this series that you do, because it's, I felt relaxed just from right from the get-go, and it's beautiful to me that, you know, in this very chaotic world, that there's people out there just putting beautiful stuff into the world every day. So thank you so much, Randy.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. I had a really good time talking to you. Well, keep up the good work, and much success if that's what you want, but just be happy, most of all. And thank you very
Amen.
Much. It's been great. Yeah. Okay. Take care, Jessica.
Thank you.
Okay.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Bye.
Bye. Thanks. So we are out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com, randifine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.